Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
If we don't move pretty quickly on a plan to get people into safe shelter and supported housing, we're going to see more and more deaths in the city.
Homeless advocates worry as outdoor deaths increase in Anchorage. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 3rd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, community leaders in Southeast say the lack of affordable housing is contributing to a labor shortage.
Without a place to stay, it's impossible for somebody to work here.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
6 people died outside in Anchorage in June. Their bodies found in city parks or just off city streets. It's the highest monthly outdoor death count in at least the past 2 years, according to data from the Anchorage Police Department. Advocates and homeless service providers say the increase is likely caused by a rise in the number of homeless campers linked to the city closing the Sullivan Arena shelter. And as Alaska Public Media's Lex Trinan reports, they say the situation could get worse without quick action.
The 6 people who died outdoors in Anchorage in June include a 56-year-old man who was found lying on the ground at a homeless camp off of 15th Avenue, a woman who was found outside of an abandoned Sam's Club building in South Anchorage, and 47-year-old John Prunes, who was found in the woods by a church on the east side of town.
He was an angel. He would do anything in the world for you. That man would give you the shirt off his back.
Rita Prunes says she doesn't know how her brother-in-law died, but he'd been homeless in Anchorage for years, bouncing around between shelters and outdoor camps. His death on June 26th is part of what homeless advocates and service providers fear is a trend. The 6 people who died in June in Anchorage represents almost 4 times the monthly average over the past 2 years. Jessica Parks oversees housing at Rural Cap, which connects people with housing. She attributes the rise in deaths to a rise in homeless people camping outside. It's grim math.
If there are more people who are unsheltered, there are going to be more unsheltered deaths.
Anchorage started turning people away from its largest homeless shelter at the Sullivan Arena in June and closed it at the end of the month. Without shelter space, parks and other homeless service providers say they saw a sharp increase in homeless people camping outdoors, and they worry that the situation is likely to continue. The city's new planned shelter won't be ready until winter. Meanwhile, the city is waiving fees for homeless people to camp at Centennial Campground. At the same time, some federal rental relief programs are ending, pushing more people into homelessness. Reverend Michael Burke of St. Mary's Episcopal Church has worked closely with people experiencing homelessness for the past 2 decades. He says this year, he's especially concerned about the fall, which he says is often the deadliest time for unsheltered homeless people.
If we don't move pretty quickly on a plan to get people into safe shelter and supported housing, we're going to see more and more deaths in the city.
Tyler Sachslaven, a spokesperson for the city health department, said in an email that the department did not want to speculate on the causes of death of people who recently died outside. He did not respond to questions about whether the department was tracking the increase in outdoor deaths and would make any changes to address it. And he disputed claims that there was an increase in outdoor camping in June, saying it's hard to measure. That goes against what the city's main service agencies have reported. Advocates point to a host of risks to people camping outside in the city, even if it's at Centennial. Lisa Souter directs Beans Cafe, the city's main soup kitchen. She says the ongoing fentanyl epidemic is a big one. At least 2 of the 6 people who died in June in Anchorage appeared to have overdosed from multiple drugs, according to the state medical examiner's office. In outdoor camps, Souter says it's harder to administer the overdose-reversing drugs like Narcan, or monitor for other emergencies.
It's not just drug overdose. It could be somebody having a seizure because they have epilepsy. It could be somebody having a stroke. It could be somebody having a heart attack.
Rita Prunes says she hopes the city can do more to find shelter for homeless people like her brother-in-law.
I think the city should be able to open more places. There's places up there that are empty, standing empty. They can open it up for them people, for the homeless people.
Service providers agree. They say building more housing and shelter is likely the only way to reduce the number of people who die outside. And they say that to make a difference before winter, the time to act is now. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Lex Trinan.
People are leaving Alaska at a rate generally faster than they have over the past 30 years, but it's not because there's a lack of work. Rather, there are more job openings in the state now than in recent memory, just fewer people to fill them. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The data on outmigration are from the August issue of Trends, the monthly report of the Alaska Department of Labor. Alaska has the relatively unique ability to track the length of time people remain in the state thanks to permanent fund applications. And with the exception of residents who were either born in Alaska or turned 18 here, people have been staying less and less time since the 1990s. Some of the drops are precipitous. In the 1990s, just over half of people who moved to Alaska in their 30s stayed here at least 10 years. Lately, however, that's fallen to about 40%. There's a similar decrease for people who moved to Alaska in their 40s, although about 5% more of them make it to the 10-year mark. In good times and bad, roughly 27,000 people move to Alaska every year, and about 5,000 of them are children. Both those numbers have dipped recently, and demographers attribute that to an overall decline in the birth rate in the United States, so fewer people with children are headed to Alaska. It's demographic changes rather than employment prospects that are likely behind the numbers. The same issue of Trends shows that the number of job openings in Alaska is near an all-time high, and rates were climbing even before the pandemic. The rate of job openings in Alaska is nearly double the national average, although both numbers are going up. Demographics likely play a role here, too, with a significant number of vacancies being created by the departure of baby boomers born between 1946 and 1964, and simply not enough younger workers to replace them. Employers are generally adapting to the new environment in ways that could ultimately benefit the economy. The authors of Trends speculate that given the difficulty of hiring staff, employers may be much less likely to let them go if the economy takes a downturn, softening the impact of a recession were one to occur. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
An Alaska-based soldier who got more than $90,000 in fraudulent military dependent benefits and the woman who married him for U.S. citizenship have admitted to having a sham marriage. Jacob Twerk and Eddie Carolina Cruz both signed plea deals filed in federal court Tuesday, in which they admitted to one felony count each of conspiracy to commit marriage fraud. The plea agreements say Twerk and Cruz were introduced to each other on Facebook, and with a plan to get money for him and citizenship for her, they married in Hawaii in 2016. They were never in a relationship and never lived together, and they filed paperwork for Cruz to become a permanent U.S. citizen, which she was granted in 2018, according to the court documents. Twerk's plea agreement also says he filed forms of the Army for dependent benefits multiple times when the military moved him to Texas and then again to Alaska. Meantime, both were dating other people, and Cruz was living in Florida. The two remained in contact, though, and shared concerns that they'd be caught, which led them to stage photos together in Alaska in 2019 to make it appear as though they'd been married and living together all along, according to the plea agreements. A judge still needs to accept the plea agreements, but prosecutors are recommending restitution in the amounts of the fraudulent benefits Twerk and Cruz received, as well as a sentence of probation. Twerk's attorney, Benjamin Muse, with the Federal Public Defender's Office, said Twerk is, quote, ashamed of his actions and feels deep remorse. He will be taking responsibility for his conduct and hopes that others can learn from his mistakes, end quote. An attorney for Cruz declined to comment. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a 17-year-old stops in Unalaska during his quest to become the youngest person to fly solo around the world.
It's quite incredible, the views you see, because you see the world from a completely different perspective.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
If you browse websites like Airbnb and Vrbo for overnight rentals in Juneau, there are dozens and dozens of listings. Many have only a handful of reviews or none at all, suggesting they only recently went on the market as vacation rentals. City officials are concerned that these kinds of listings may be eating into Juneau's already very limited housing stock. On Monday, the Juneau Assembly approved spending $20,000 to hire a third-party firm to collect data about this market. City Finance Director Jeff Rogers explained how firms like this work during an Assembly committee meeting last month.
We think of those third-party services principally as reconnaissance. They're snooping, crawling the web, looking at rentals, trying to see how often those rentals are rented, what the approximate rates are. There's some work that most of those companies do on the back end to line up a rental listing with a parcel and potentially with an owner.
In a recent survey, business leaders in Southeast Alaska identified a lack of affordable housing as the top barrier to economic growth, indicating that it directly contributes to labor shortages. The Assembly has also been considering mandating that operators of short-term rentals register their properties with the city. Together, these may be early steps toward limiting Airbnbs and similar rentals in Juneau. The Petersburg Borough Assembly voted to form a task group on housing. They're looking for community members willing to seek solutions to a shortage of available living space. KFSK's Joe Vicnicki reports.
Assemblymember Jeff Mucci proposed forming a task force of 12 to 15 members of the community to seek housing solutions. It would be similar to a group that the Assembly formed this spring for early childhood education.
I think we, you know, like childcare, I think this is one of the most important issues facing Petersburg. Every person that we've hired within the borough over the last several months, police officers, up at the fire department, Mountain View Manor, they were all looking for houses. And without a place to stay, it's impossible for somebody to work here.
Mucci has joined others in calling Petersburg's housing shortage a crisis. He noted a separate citizens group that's already been meeting on the issue this year, and he thought that could become part of a new task force. The problems come up throughout the country. It was cited as the number one workforce problem for most businesses in Southeast during an annual survey this year. The lack of housing was also noted in Petersburg's 2016 comprehensive plan, which includes a chapter on that topic. It recommends opening up new land for development, allowing smaller lot sizes and multiple dwelling units on the same lot, among other solutions. Assemblymember Dave Kensinger thought the local government had a better chance of addressing the housing problem than the lack of space in childcare programs.
Unlike childcare, housing is something that the borough can have an impact on because the borough has the largest reservoir of unoccupied land in the area. And then also through planning and zoning, simple changes that a lot of communities around the country are making now in their planning and zoning codes.
Assembly members agreed a work session could help narrow the focus for a new task force. The Assembly could appoint that task force at their first meeting in October. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
The sockeye salmon runs to the Chignik River are at their highest escapement in at least 9 years. And that's welcome news after 4 years of extremely low returns. As KDLG's Brian Venua reports, Chignik officials think that might have something to do with recent management changes to Area M's commercial fishery.
The Chignik River has an early and a late sockeye run. The early runs escapement is now over 420,000, and the late runs escapement is nearly 240,000 as of July 31. It's the first time the early sockeye run has met its minimum escapement since it collapsed in 2018. The Alaska Board of Fisheries designated the early run as a stock of management concern in March as part of an agreement between the Chignik Intertribal Coalition and the Area M. Saners Association. The Chignik Intertribal Coalition originally proposed to indefinitely reduce Area M's harvest around the Shumigan Islands by about half until the Chignik River passes the early run's minimum escapement goal. But the board's final decision is a compromise that will allow Area M fishers to harvest at full capacity once the Chignik early run is no longer a stock of management concern. The president of the Chignik Intertribal Coalition, George Anderson, was one of the people who supported that change.
The first attempt at having this possibly might have worked because we finally hit our lower end of our escapement goal for our early run this year and have achieved our late-run escapement goals.
Area M is a mixed-stock fishery. Fisher folk there catch salmon swimming to rivers and lakes in that area, but they also harvest fish headed to spawning grounds further away. Anderson says while the factors that determine Chignik's escapement are likely more complex than just Area M's harvest, he thinks it could be a major factor.
It's very possible that these restrictions benefited our area and allowed for us a fish to escape.
Anderson says he's excited about the new strategy, but he says the Chignik's will need more support in order to have a sustainable commercial fishery.
We do have some proposals in for this upcoming winter's meeting, and where we will be asking for additional changes so we can not only achieve escapement, but possibly get some yield and some harvestable surplus in our area.
Chuck McCollum is the Lake and Peninsula Borough Fisheries Advisor. He also thinks the closure was just one factor in this year's higher returns, but the forecast was also higher.
We're dealing with a natural system, so the interception is part of it and nature is the other part, and we do the best we can with what we're given.
Kylie Thompson is the president of the Area M. Saners Association. Thompson says the association agreed to the change because he and other fishermen want to see Chignik's succeed as well.
Supported that because when the stock of concern is lifted, the regulations will be lifted, and you know we want to see more fish go up Chignik. It benefits everyone.
But Thompson says Area M communities also depend on salmon, and he's wary of further fishing restrictions.
Without the salmon fisheries, healthy salmon fisheries, these communities are absolutely going to fail.
Carl Burnside became the Fish and Game's Chignik Area Management Biologist in April. He says he thinks it's more likely that improved spawning conditions have helped boost returns.
We think it's more likely that the biggest thing helping it out is just that rearing conditions improved in fresh and salt water.
But Burnside says this could be a turning point for the Chignik fishery.
Assuming that they have favorable conditions going forward, then you know this run will produce a much larger one 4 or 5 years from now that should be harvestable.
Anderson with the Chignik Intertribal Coalition says that until the fishery has fully recovered, he hopes the Board of Fish will continue to consider further support.
Was the Board of Fisheries responsibility to, you know, share the wealth when fish are coming back good, but it's also their responsibility to share the burden of conservation across all users.
The next Board of Fisheries FinFish meeting for Chignik and the Alaska Peninsula is set for February. In Dillingham, I'm Brian Venois.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The IBEW is the union of skilled hands and generous hearts, hardworking people on the job and off. It's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW. This message sponsored by the IBEW Local 1547.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
The University of Alaska Foundation has created a new fund to support Ukrainian students and attending this fall. The Ukrainian Student Support Fund will help them pay for tuition, textbooks, and other expenses at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Jim Bowers established the fund. He's a longtime supporter of UAA student scholarships, and he says he was haunted by news footage of destroyed Ukrainian universities.
You see a bunch of literally shell-shocked people, you know, days before their college has been blown up, and I just imagined, you know, what's life like when you wake up one morning and everything's what you're used to and normal. And then that afternoon, you're being evacuated, and what are you going to do?
UAA's International Student Services Office will help incoming students apply for the fund. According to the New Chance Ukraine Relief Program, 230 Ukrainians have resettled in Alaska so far, and 100 more are awaiting final paperwork. They expect a third of them will be students. UAA says it's received inquiries from Ukrainian students who are interested in attending this fall. A reward is being offered for information about the illegal killing of a trumpeter swan in Fairbanks. A U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service press release says the agency is offering $500 for information leading to the arrest and conviction of those involved in the shooting of an adult swan found floating dead in a pond along Chena Hot Springs Road June 15th. It says trumpeter swans, which are one of the largest flying bird species in the world, are protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and Alaska state law. Violations of the act carry maximum criminal penalties of up to $15,000 and 6 months in federal prison. Anyone with information about the swan killing is asked to contact the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service or Alaska State Troopers. Federal officials are looking for ways to boost abalone stocks for subsistence and sport harvest. As KRBD's Reagan Miller reports, an Alaska Sea Grant Fellow recently traveled to Prince of Wales Island to hear some ideas from residents.
Abalone is technically a marine snail. It comes in a mottled pink and green shell with wispy tentacles around the broad muscle that acts as a foot, keeping it anchored to the rocks. But a past record of overharvesting has officials worried about the stunted population and reduced genetic diversity. Ocean acidification also impacts the coastal waters that the abalone call home. NOAA reports that illegal poaching of abalone is still occurring, despite the regulations in place. Now, scientists are looking for ways to bring back a lively supply of abalone in Southeast. Ashley Bulwark recently took a trip to Prince of Wales Island to hear ideas from residents. She's an Alaska Sea Grant Fellow with the Habitat Conservation Section of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
I have been facilitating an abalone working group here in Southeast Alaska, which has been trying to bring together tribes and scientists and nonprofit organizations to have conversations about the future of abalone and how we can look at abalone sustainability and recovery in some places.
Bulwark made the trip to the island to share the news that there's now a digital survey Alaskans can take to share their thoughts about the issue. She also met with some of NOAA's tribal partners while on the island.
You know, this conversation in the abalone working group is sort of starting at the ground level of building relationships so that we can work together across organizations and tribes and with scientists and just think about how we can collaborate and really help one another.
Bulwark says the conversations aren't aimed at kickstarting the commercial harvest of abalone again. That's something that's been off the table since 1996. And sport fishing of abalone has been banned since 2013. Subsistence harvest of the critters by hand on the shore is still allowed, but limits were reduced to 5 per day in 2012.
No one knows what the future looks like realistically, but most of the conversation is around subsistence and sport harvest.
Bulwark visited POW about a year ago. Heidelberg Cooperative Association environmental planner Tony Sanderson says she approached the tribe to learn more about the abalone.
The first time she came around was for the indigenous knowledge on where the abalone were, you know, and so we had a few different folks bring her out and show them where they used to harvest abalone. And then she came through with a dive team in certain sites and dove to assess the population of the abalone.
Then Bulwark participated in a dive study to see what the abalone population in Heidelberg's waters looked like. Sanderson said what she found didn't offer a lot of hope to the people of Heidelberg.
I mean, the numbers were really, really low as far as the, you know, like 5-inch abalone. And one thing she did tell me is they only have to be up to 3.5 inches before they start spawning. You know, so they don't have to be real big, but we over the years we've seen our abalone going down to pretty much where you can't even harvest them anymore.
Bulwark says that efforts like the trip help to form relationships between researchers, tribes, and residents. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
A 17-year-old is on a quest to be the youngest person ever to fly solo around the world. He landed in Unalaska on Monday. KUCB's Laura Lynn Cruz caught up with him.
How are you, Mac?
Very good. Thank
you. Welcome.
Welcome to Dutch Harbor.
Thank you very much.
How was the flight in?
Very nice. Yeah.
Mac Rutherford is greeted by Port Director for Customs and Border Protection George Dominguez and others at the airport in Unalaska. It's been months and thousands of miles since the young soloist started his journey. He left Bulgaria in late March and made his way across Africa and Asia. Over the past few days, he's flown up the Aleutian chain, from Attu to Shimia to Adak.
It's quite incredible, the views you see, because you see the world from a completely different perspective. From the air, you can really see the general landscape and see how the country is, but in a way that you wouldn't be able to on the ground.
Rutherford is Belgian and British and comes from a family of aviators. He says his sister was his inspiration. She completed her own around-the-world flight earlier this year. Following in her footsteps, Rutherford got his pilot's license at age 15, setting the record for youngest pilot in the world. He has a lot of experience flying for someone his age, but he says there's been a lot to learn on this trip.
It's completely different in many parts of the world. So in Africa, I had quite a few problems with visibility or mountains, things like that. But when I got to India, for example, it was monsoon season, so it was big storms. It's quite interesting how all these different places have different challenges.
The challenge near Unalaska, flying over the mountains and then dropping down to sea level. Rutherford had to make a second attempt at landing.
I was flying in way too high because to get over the mountains, I had to go to I was at 7,500 feet. And then suddenly I had to descend a huge amount because this is basically at sea level. And so once I tried to do my approach, I was still too high. So I had to go around and try again. And the second time I was able to do it.
From Unalaska, Rutherford is scheduled to stop in Anchorage. From there, he'll fly to Ketchikan and then down the west coast to Mexico. He expects to complete his journey in Bulgaria in late August. In Unalaska, I'm Laura Lynn Cruz.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Lex Trinan in Anchorage, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Joe Viknicki in Petersburg, Brian Venwa in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Reagan Miller in Ketchikan, and Laura Lynn Cruz in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
And by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.